For this Tuesday, April the 27th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. The CDC announcing new guidelines saying Americans who have been fully vaccinated against COVID no longer need to wear masks for many outdoor activities unless they're in a crowd. We'll have the details just ahead. Because of COVID, the deadline for air travelers to upgrade to the Real ID, it has been pushed back 19 months from October 1st this year to May 23rd of 2023. News on the economy with home prices rising at their fastest pace since 2014, jumping nearly 12% in February, the most recent numbers available today. Congress will be returning to those congressional earmarks, allowing lawmakers to request funding for some home state projects. And there are new tensions between the House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and the number three in the leadership, Representative Liz Cheney. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today. Ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with today's briefing by the CDC announcing that fully vaccinated people can exercise and attend small gatherings outdoors without wearing a face mask. Dining unmasked at an outdoor restaurant with friends from multiple households, that also is acceptable. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She outlined the new details earlier today.
If you are fully vaccinated and want to attend a small outdoor gathering with people who are vaccinated and unvaccinated, or dine at an outdoor restaurant with friends from multiple households, the science shows if you are vaccinated, you can do so safely unmasked. On the CDC website, we have posted examples of numerous outdoor activities that are safe to do without a mask if you are fully vaccinated. Generally, for vaccinated people, outdoor activities without a mask are safe. However, we continue to recommend masking in crowded outdoor settings and venues, such as packed stadiums and concerts, where there is decreased ability to maintain physical distance and where many unvaccinated people may also be present. We will continue to recommend this until widespread vaccination is achieved. Now let's talk about what you can do indoors. Here again, we have unvaccinated people and their risk on the left, where nothing has changed. Risk is indicated and masking is required. We then show the markedly decreased risk for vaccinated people on the right. Given what we know about COVID-19 vaccines and their efficacy, it is also safe for those who are fully vaccinated to return to the activities they love doing inside while wearing a mask. The guiding principles we released today and the illustrative examples compare the safety of several activities if you are vaccinated or not, and the difference is clear. As we gather more and more data on the real-world efficacy of vaccines, we know that masked, fully vaccinated people can safely attend worship services inside, go to an indoor restaurant or bar, and even participate in an indoor exercise class. Although these vaccines are extremely effective, we know that the virus spreads very well indoors. Until more people are vaccinated, and while we still have more than 50,000 cases a day, mask use indoors will provide extra protection.
Dr. Walensky is the CDC director, so let's look at the numbers, the latest from the CDC, indicating that more than 140 million Americans, that's just over 42% of the total adult population, receiving at least one dose of the COVID vaccine, and of that number, just over 95 million Americans are fully vaccinated. President Biden with these remarks.
But beginning today, gathering with a group of friends in a park, going for a picnic, as long as you are vaccinated and outdoors, you can do it without a mask. The CDC is able to make this announcement because our scientists are convinced by the data that the odds of getting or giving the virus to others is very, very low if you've both been fully vaccinated and out in the open air. The CDC also help clarify which outdoor activities are safer or less safe, depending on whether you've been vaccinated. The bottom line is clear. If you're vaccinated, you can do more things more safely, both outdoors as well as indoors. So for those who haven't gotten their vaccination yet, especially if you're younger or think you don't need it, this is another great reason to go get vaccinated. Now. Now. Yes, the vaccines are about saving your life, but also the lives of the people around you. But they're also about helping you get back to closer to normal in our living.
That from the president earlier today. He was just outside the White House. And from the New York Times, there is this headline: "This is a catastrophe. In India, illness is everywhere. As the country suffers the world's worst coronavirus crisis, our New Delhi bureau chief describing the fear of living amid a disease spreading at such a scale and speed." Jeffrey Gettleman writing the following, quote, "Crematories are so full of bodies, it's as if war just happened. Fire is burning around the clock. Many places are holding mass cremations, dozens at a time. And at night, in certain areas of New Delhi, the sky is glowing. Sickness and death are everywhere in India. Dozens of houses in my neighborhood have sick people. India now recording more infections per day, as many as 350,000, than any other country has since the pandemic began. And that is just the official number. Most experts think it is a vast underestimate. A few days ago, the positivity rate hit a staggering 36%. That means more than one out of three people tested were infected. A month ago, it was less than 3%. The full story is available tonight at nytimes.com. President Biden speaking about the situation in India earlier today.
With regard to India, I spoke at length with Modi, the Prime Minister. We are sending immediately a whole series of help that he needs, including providing for those remdesivir and other drugs that are able to deal with this and prevent, in some cases, but help recovery. Secondly, we are sending the actual mechanical parts that are needed for the machinery they have to build a vaccine. And that's being done as well. We're also discussed with him when we'll be able to send actual vaccines to India, which will be my intention to do. The problem is right now we have to make sure we have other vaccines like Novavax and others coming on probably. And I think we'll be in a position to be able to share vaccines as well as know-how with other countries who are in real need. That's the hope and expectation. And I might add, when we were in a bind at the very beginning, India helped us. Thank you.
That from the president. And a group of Republican lawmakers, who are also physicians, releasing their own video today urging all Americans to get the COVID-19 vaccine. It comes amid a number of polling showing that Republicans have a higher hesitancy to get the jab. The video is led by Senator Roger Marshall, Republican of Kansas, who is a doctor, and featuring some of the lawmakers wearing white coats with stethoscopes around their necks, speaking directly into the camera. Also participating, Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, Senator John Bozeman of Arkansas, and seven Republican House members.
I come to you today not only as a United States Senator, but as a physician concerned for the health and safety of our nation.
And today I want to talk with you about getting your COVID vaccine.
Last year, the entire world was forced to face the COVID-19 pandemic head on.
And now we, the American people, have the opportunity to achieve peace of mind
and live life as free as before by choosing to receive a COVID-19 vaccine.
Look, this vaccine is safe.
Operation Warp Speed brought us safe and effective vaccines, and all in record time.
The process was rigorous and transparent, and a process that I personally followed very, very closely,
resulting in a clear path to the eradication of the pandemic. The FDA did not skip any steps.
Instead, they cut bureaucratic red tape, not corners, and they got the job done in record time.
And by now, over 100 million vaccines have been given in our country.
And it's obvious to me from a medical standpoint, the only way to protect ourselves and your loved ones
and to end the government's restrictions on our freedoms is to take action and get the vaccine.
The beauty of living in this great nation is, however, that we have the option to choose whether or not we get vaccinated.
When the time comes for you to make that final decision, talk it over with your doctor or your pharmacist and consider their recommendation.
doctors, nurses, and pharmacists nationwide recommend the COVID-19 vaccine to their patients.
And over 90% of doctors in the United States have already chosen to get vaccinated.
I look forward to the freedom that I, along with my loved ones, will regain once the vast majority of Americans are vaccinated.
If everyone does their part, in the coming weeks, we will once again be able to worship together as a congregation.
Gather with extended family and travel near and far with friends.
I hope you'll join me.
I hope you'll join me.
I hope you'll join me.
I hope you'll join me, along with over 100 million Americans,
in choosing to receive the vaccine so we can throw away our mask and live life as free as we did before.
That from Republican members of Congress, the House and the Senate, who are also trained physicians, a new ad urging Americans to get vaccinated. Meanwhile, those vaccinated shoppers are beginning to return to malls and retail plazas, offering hope that the worst of the economic downturn during this pandemic may be turning a corner. The Wall Street Journal is reporting on the higher foot traffic, and earlier today we talked to reporter Esther Fung about this development.
So I've been to a few malls, and I've definitely seen more people there. It feels like there's a lot of pent-up demand to go shopping, to be in a store with other people, and to touch and feel clothes, and to go get the pretzel. So it feels like people are definitely returning.
When you talk to the retailers, what are they telling you? What's foot traffic been like over the last couple of weeks, and how did they survive the last year?
So for some retailers, they said that things were picking up slowly late last year when they could reopen. And then one of them said to me that in February, during Valentine's Day, there were so many people who came in to buy gifts for their loved ones. It feels like after the punishment of last year, they felt that they should go out to spend money to buy gifts, to eat in restaurants, and they're hoping that this exuberance would still carry on till the summer.
But if you go to some of the malls, including here in the Washington, D.C. area, you will see a lot of empty storefronts. How have the bankruptcy issues affected these retailers and so many that are basically shutting down?
Sure. Yes, there have been lots of store closures that have been occurring for years. And for many of these places where there has been an oversupply of stores, there are just way too many stores for a very small population, retailers have decided to close and shutter stores there. And this presents a problem for many properties who are unable to reinvent themselves. These properties would have to close. And for remaining properties who are able to still draw in the most relevant and the most popular retailers, to them, this actually presents a healthier competitive environment. The demand and supply dynamics would be less imbalanced, but we are still not there yet. There would still be further store closures ahead, but it may not be as big a number as we're used to seeing in recent years.
And as you point out in your reporting, a jump in sales offering hope to a beleaguered industry. Esther Fung, her work available at WSJ.com. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow with only a modest gain, up 3 points. The S&P off a fraction. The Nasdaq losing 48.5. And meanwhile, CNBC's Steve Leisman is reporting that Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is a heavy favorite on Wall Street to be renominated for a second term by President Biden, even while there are some substantial disagreements with some aspects of Fed policy. The CNBC Fed survey for April finding that 76% of those respondents believe that the president will choose Powell again. He was nominated to be the chair by President Trump. His term expires in 2022. He first began his 4-year term back in 2018. There is also another health warning coming tonight from the CDC for parents of newborn children. A majority of unexpected deaths among young babies still involve soft bedding, despite decades of safe back-to-sleep messaging targeting those new parents. The research published today in the Journal of Pediatrics finding that blankets, pillows, crib bumpers, stuffed animals, and sleep surfaces other than cribs remain the leading causes of accidental suffocation among those babies 4 months old and younger. Now, the study analyzed data from nearly 5,000 cases of SIDS, sudden unexpected infant death, from 2011 to 2017. Soft bedding was associated with 72% of the cases. Very young infants unable to move away from suffocation hazards that impair their ability to breathe. And this reminder from the CDC to always place your child on his or her back, not the stomach. You can go to the American Academy of Pediatrics. The website is aap.org for more information. And now to some internal politics among House Republicans. GOP leader Kevin McCarthy refusing to say whether Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming should be on the Republican leadership team. It is another sign of internal strife that began during former President Trump's impeachment. Representative Cheney is the third highest ranking Republican in the House. She voted to impeach President Trump earlier this year, prompting calls from some fellow Republicans that she should be removed from her leadership post. Now, she defeated the challenge back in February and remains in that position. We'll have more details just ahead on that story. All of this coming as House Republicans wrap up a two-day retreat in Orlando, Florida. Congressman McCarthy was asked whether the two parties can come together on some of the major agenda items now before Congress.
Coming into this administration, when I sat there at the inaugural, I thought there'd be a lot of places we could have bipartisanship. I think it's more in the first 100 days this president doesn't want bipartisanship. If you listen to the White House, they don't believe bipartisanship is working with any Republicans. They think somehow they just title it that. You would never produce bills of those trillions of dollars if it was bipartisanship. You would never have a COVID bill that less than 9% goes to COVID. You'd never have an infrastructure bill that only has 6% of it. You'd never have an infrastructure bill that puts more money into subsidizing electric cars than it does for building roads, airports, and highways combined. So they've got to come a long way, but I will tell you from a Republican point of view, we are willing to work with anybody. We want to solve these problems, and if they won't do it, that's what you're finding here at this retreat from our policy task forces, we will.
The House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, in Orlando, Florida. And joining us on the phone here in Washington is Mike Lillis, who is covering the story for TheHill.com. Another part of the retreat story is somebody who was not invited, former President Donald Trump. What can you tell us?
Well, you know, it's not unusual that the former president would not be invited. Sitting presidents are usually a regular feature at these annual conferences, both for the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, Obama and Biden, for that matter, were regular attendees at the Democrats' retreats over those 8 years. And then Trump was when he was in office for the past four. This year, I think there was a little bit of a different expectation that Trump might be invited just because, for one thing, he retained such popularity within the party, both in Congress and outside of it, but also because the retreat is down in Orlando. So it's just a short flight away from Mar-a-Lago, which, of course, is where he has gone since leaving the White House. So just the proximity of it and his popularity, people thought that he might be invited. But of course, he is not there. And Kevin McCarthy, who is one of his still most vocal allies on Capitol Hill, is saying, well, that, you know, why would he be there? We just talk about issues. This isn't about politics, which is not quite the case. These retreats are very much about politics, and especially for the minority party, which is not going to be there talking about legislation because they don't control the floor schedule. They're not writing legislation. They're down there talking about messaging and how to win back the House, and Donald Trump is going to play a big part of that. So, you know, the speculation is that because of the divisions within the leadership and with Liz Cheney in particular, that it would have been just too divisive to have him down there. And nobody's saying that out loud, of course, because that only exacerbates those divisions. But that seems to be the story here.
Well, let me ask you about the House Republican Conference Chair Liz Cheney, because Leader McCarthy was asked about a political divide between the two. Here's what he had to say.
Is Cheney still a good fit for your leadership team, do you believe?
That's a question for the conference.
But what do you believe? What do you believe?
I think from a perspective, if you're sitting here at a retreat, it's focused on policy and focused on the future of making America the next century. And you're talking about something else, you're not being productive.
And of course, that's something else, Liz Cheney indicating that she may run for president in 2024. But Mike Lillis, what's going on here?
Well, yeah, that's a fascinating answer from Kevin McCarthy that just happened today, of course. And the reason that's interesting is because Liz Cheney was one of just 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump after the January 6th attack on the Capitol. She really went out on a limb there. She became kind of anathema within the caucus, within the conference, and they, in fact, had a closed-door vote to try to kick her out of the leadership. There were a lot of conservatives in the conference who said, hey, wait a minute, Trump is still our standard bearer. He's still popular. He's still our guy. And if we have the number three House Republican who's just attacking him publicly and going out of her way to, in fact, vote to impeach our guy, then she has no standing left in the conference and she shouldn't be there. And in that closed door meeting, Kevin McCarthy stood up and said, no, Liz Cheney is on our side. She still has great value within the conference, and he supported her very vocally. And so for him now not to be doing that in public is quite a shift. And I think there'll be a lot more speculation about why that is happening now and actually what's going to happen with her as the leadership moves forward, because, again, they think they have great odds of winning back the House in 2022. They only need to flip five seats. And of course, Kevin McCarthy's in line for speakership. There's no mystery that he wants to be Speaker of the House. And if he sees her as an impediment to getting there, he certainly sees Trump as an asset in getting there. If he sees Liz Cheney as an impediment, then they're going to have some problems. And they're going to either have to work them out or we might see another conference vote. And if Kevin McCarthy is not back, and or might have a different outcome the next time around.
A story we will be following, your work at thehill.com. Mike Lillis, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. Anytime.
Meanwhile, the president will deliver remarks before a joint session of Congress tomorrow evening, marking 98 days after he was sworn in. Now, most recent presidents have given their first speech just weeks into the start of their administration. The pandemic and Capitol Hill security, two reasons for the delay. Security, of course, remains extremely tight across Capitol Hill. A grand total of 200 will be inside the chamber. That, of course, is a fraction of how many usually squeeze in for a speech like this. And only the Chief Justice, John Roberts, will be in attendance to represent the judicial branch. Earlier today, this update from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki on what to expect.
Well, the major policy announcement in the speech is, of course, the American Families Plan, a historic investment in education and child care. He will also use the speech as an opportunity to talk about many of his other priorities, including police reform, immigration, gun safety, his ongoing work to get the pandemic under control, and to putting Americans back to work. He was in the Senate for 36 years. He also sat through eight of these as the vice president, and he certainly recognizes the important opportunity that this offers. In attendance, there will be the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, as well as, I think, the Supreme Court confirmed the Chief Justice will be in attendance. Joining him will be Dr. Biden, the Vice President, and, of course, the Second Gentleman. There will not be a First Lady's box, as there has been historically. While the speech will, of course, look and feel different from past years, the President will preserve a few traditions, including the walk down the center aisle that we have seen presidents do for many years. He will, of course, be wearing a mask for that. He'll remove the mask when he delivers his speech. He'll also be meeting with men and women, a career staff, who were at the Capitol on January 6th in advance of the speech.
Will he bring up, I know he'll have a foreign policy piece. Mm-hmm. Will there be a lot of talk about China in this speech?
I expect there certainly will be a foreign policy speech. It's never as much foreign policy as the foreign policy team wants. That's always the battle. But there will be a foreign policy portion of the speech. He will talk about his commitment to reengaging with the world, taking America's seat back in the world, what our values are as a country. And certainly I would expect he'll talk about a number of the priorities of this administration, including our engagement with China.
from today's White House briefing. And this note, it is not a State of the Union, although it will look and feel very much like that because it's his first few months in office. It is being called a speech before a joint session of Congress. Live coverage gets underway 8 p.m. Eastern time here on C-SPAN Radio and live on C-SPAN Television. The president's speech will start an hour later at 9 p.m., followed by the Republican response from Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. As always, we want to hear from you. Our phone lines will be open throughout the evening to get your reaction tomorrow here on the C-SPAN Networks. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio, also available as a podcast. The FBI confirming it will open a civil rights investigation into the death of Andrew Brown Jr. He was the black man fatally shot by sheriff's deputies in North Carolina last week. Police in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, shooting Brown five times, including in the back of his head. That according to an independent autopsy report. And of course, this follows yesterday's announcement by the Attorney General Merrick Garland launching an investigation into the policing practices of the Louisville Police Department. And that follows the shooting of Breonna Taylor, a black emergency technician who was killed during a botched raid inside her Kentucky apartment. Here in Washington, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren releasing her plan to help families get affordable child care. The price tag, $700 billion. It's called the Universal Child Care and Early Learning Act. It would, among other things, ensure that families making up to twice the federal poverty line would be guaranteed free access to child care. Now, those families earning more would pay a subsidized amount based on their income. But according to Senator Warren, no family would pay more than 7% of their overall income for child care. Here are more details from her news conference earlier today.
Today, millions of women, principally, are not able to go back to work because they can't find child care. If this pandemic has shown us nothing else, it has shown us the critical importance of parents having access to dependable child care. So, we recognize that as we build a stronger future for America, a big part of that is rebuilding an infrastructure system, and that infrastructure system must include child care. High quality child care is good for our babies, high quality child care is good for their parents, and high quality child care is good for the workers who provide this care. You know, when President Biden introduced his infrastructure package, he talked about the importance of infrastructure, but he also talked about the importance of the good jobs that rebuilding our infrastructure helps create. That's great. And building a system that has lots of good jobs in roads and bridge construction is exactly the right thing for America, but we need to do the same with child care. We need to build good jobs for the women who provide the care across America. So we are here today to support a $700 billion investment in child care and early learning. We are here to support an investment in the future of our children, the future of the parents, and the future of their caregivers and teachers. We will fight for all of our babies to have access to high quality care and a bright future.
That from Senator Elizabeth Warren earlier today. Now, the president is expected to unveil his own plan that, if approved, could mean a massive expansion of taxpayer dollar spending. It comes on the same day as the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee holding a hearing on the role of the federal government in child care and in education. Republican Senator Richard Burr making these comments earlier today.
Most critical, however, is that we understand parents' want and needs for child care going forward. I cannot say it enough. Parent choice and flexibility is paramount. Nothing is more personal than the choice a parent makes of who will take care of their infant, toddler, or four-year-old. Because children develop on different timelines, parents may prefer one type of provider for one child and another type of provider for another child. And we need options for parents to meet their schedules. One size fits all does not work in childcare. Parents, not government, know their children best. Whatever we do in child care policy, we must respect and support parents' choices. Additionally, it's essential we understand any unintended consequences of good meaning but poorly thought through policy ideas that may drive up child care costs and make it more difficult for providers to operate and enter the field, or make it even harder to attract and retain a qualified workforce. As just one example of potential unintended consequences is a poorly designed universal pre-kindergarten program. Pushing four-year-olds out of developmentally supportive community child care programs and into an already poorly performing K-12 system runs the risk of disrespecting the wants of parents, significantly driving up the cost of already expensive infant and toddler care, and setting young children back in their social, emotional, and academic growth. We presently have a rich and diverse mixed delivery system for child care and early education in this country. Centers, family child care homes, for-profit, nonprofit, religious, large, small. As we look to improve access, affordability, and quality in child care and stabilize and better support a labor-intensive, thin-margin industry, we must do so in ways that build up the things we have right, respecting parents' choices in the care of their young children through a rich and diverse mixed delivery system. I hope today's a start and not the end of a bipartisan conversation on how to make child care better for America's working families.
That's from today's Senate Help Committee with North Carolina Republican Senator Richard Burr. It's available on our website at cspan.org. Meanwhile, the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Patrick Leahy of Vermont, Democrat, announcing the official return of earmarks. Now, this could clear the way for lawmakers to request funds for their own pet projects. Jennifer Schott is covering that story for CQ Roll Call. And late today, we began our conversation by asking for a definition of the term itself.
So earmarks are a way that individual members of Congress from throughout the country can ask the Appropriations Committees in the House and Senate for money for a variety of community projects in their districts or in their states. And this is pretty varied. It can be anything from an Army Corps of Engineer projects to something relating to agriculture, to other sort of community projects that they may want to secure federal funding for, particularly if those projects have gone unfunded in the past.
Will this in any way bring down the temperature, the political partisanship that we've seen in Congress over the last few years?
It could a little bit on the appropriations process. That's something myself and a lot of others are really planning to track with a return to earmarks in the House and Senate this year. And so one of the things that I think is going to be really interesting to see is whether or not these appropriations bills, once they're written in a few months and make their way to the floors, get broad bipartisan support, and especially if people who get earmarks in these bills will vote for them on the floor. I think that's going to be sort of the first test of whether or not this can bring back some significant bipartisanship to the beginning part of the appropriations process.
And they were banned about 10 years ago in 2011. Why?
There was a lot of concerns from conservative Republicans and some Democrats, including then President Barack Obama, that earmarks were not being used in a responsible way or for the most needed projects throughout the country. And so at the time, congressional leaders and the Obama administration decided that they would completely ban earmarks because some transparency mechanisms and guardrails that were put in place ahead of the 2011 ban hadn't done everything that they wanted to do in terms of making the process a bit more above board. And earmarks also have a bit of a negative connotation in a lot of conservative Republican circles. And so that's going to be something that most likely continues, but that this process could change a little bit.
We are talking with Jennifer Schott, her work available at rollcall.com. What about the new guardrails? What precautions will be put in place by the House and the Senate?
So the House and Senate have slightly different versions of how earmarks are going to work for appropriation bills in those chambers. But some of the overarching guardrails are that total earmarks will be capped at about 1% of discretionary spending, which for the current fiscal year total discretionary spending is roughly $1.4 trillion. Members are going to have to post their earmark requests online with sort of some details about where the money would go and why they think the funding, why the projects are worthy of federal funding. And those projects are going to be sort of publicly available. And so those are some of the big changes that are coming to that process.
And a procedural question in terms of the Senate, can a single senator raise what is often called the point of order objection to an earmark?
Not to an earmark itself, but there is a provision in Senate rules that will allow senators to raise a point of order if an appropriations bill comes to the floor for a procedural vote known as motion to proceed, without a 48-hour window where the earmarks in that appropriations bill were posted online. I also believe there's a point of order on the Senate floor against voting on an appropriations conference report, I believe also within that 48-hour window.
A return of earmarks in Congress, the reporting of Jennifer Shutt. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In other news on this Tuesday, now serving as a U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change in the Biden administration, former Secretary of State John Kerry facing calls for his resignation from a number of Republican lawmakers for reportedly discussing Israeli military operations with Iran's foreign minister when he served as President Obama's Secretary of State. The White House dismissing the allegations, saying the information that Kerry allegedly shared was widely known at the time. But Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan yesterday saying John Kerry must leave his position.
If this is true, if John Kerry told Iran, the leaders of Iran, about issues relating to our most critical ally in the region, Israel, who Iran has repeatedly said they want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. If he did this, he needs to resign. If he did this with the intent of undermining the current president of the United States at the time, President Trump, and the members of this body, he needs to resign. Madam President, he is a member of the current administration's National Security Council. It's become clear, Madam President, that our adversaries, whether Beijing or Iran, like it when John Kerry is in charge of foreign policy and national security. Why? Because they know how to use him to their advantage. And our allies fear him. Why? Because they know his judgment is off on so many issues. So too do America's working families.
That from Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican, and the New York Times first reporting yesterday that leaked audio recordings back in March capturing Iran's foreign minister claiming that John Kerry told him Israel had attacked Iran's interest in Syria at least 200 times. The former Secretary of State categorically denying the allegations in a tweet last night saying, quote, "This never happened, either when I was Secretary of State or since." Meanwhile, the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, telling the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the Biden administration would press for what he calls meaningful participation for women and minorities in the ongoing peace talks. Now, U.S. forces are preparing to withdraw by September 11th with a promise from the White House to preserve civil rights in the country and warning the Taliban there will be severe consequences if those guarantees are not met. Senator Bob Menendez is the committee chair.
Why do you think the Taliban has been fighting for over the course of the past 20 years? What's their goal?
They've argued that they are fighting to get the international forces, the foreign forces, out of their country, and that they regard those forces as occupation forces.
Mm. Would you agree that their vision has been to establish an emirate that would return Afghanistan to the brand of governance seen before 9/11?
That has been their stated vision, but they've also have said that they have changed since in the dark days when they ruled Afghanistan in the 1990s.
But their desire to establish an emirate is, I still their vision. If that is the case, What makes us think that giving them, that they will give up now from their stated vision now that U.S. forces are leaving? Do you really think, for example, that the incentives of international legitimacy, lifting of sanctions, international assistance will be all it takes for them to peacefully participate in the democratic process?
I think those factors they say are important, but more important it is that they cannot have a peace in the foreseeable future, and they will have a long war confronting them because their fellow Afghans, those that support the Republic, for example, do not support the restoration of an emirate or the emirate back in Afghanistan.
No, I know their fellow Afghans don't, but they do. And militarily, they seem to have already covered a good part of the country. I know that there's rising violence in Kabul, and we are far from a withdrawal. So I'm trying to understand why they are suddenly going to change the dynamics of what their stated goal is when they will have less of a consequence to meet the a challenge to meet them as they try to pursue that goal. And so that's one of the challenges I have in trying to understand what we're doing here.
Those comments by Senator Menendez, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan. Again, a reminder, live coverage of the president's address before a joint session of Congress tomorrow evening. His remarks getting underway at 9 Eastern, 6 o'clock for those of you on the West Coast. This is the Tuesday edition of Washington Today. I'm Steve Scully, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.